This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare.
Where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey.
Serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England.
Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Since it was published in 2011, the 50 Shades of Grey erotica series has sold more than 100 million copies, been turned into a major motion picture, and made E.L. James one of the world's top-earning authors 3 years running. Not too shabby for a book that got its start online as Twilight fan fiction. Once relegated to fanzines, Star Trek conventions, and occasionally the bookstore, technology has made fan fiction more widely disseminated, more mainstream, and in some cases more of a headache for authors who inspired the fans in the first place. Joining me now to discuss the sometimes rocky relationship between authors and fan fiction is Laura Miller. She's a literary critic whose essay, You Belong to Me, we found in New York Magazine. Laura Miller, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with Stephanie Myers, the author of the Twilight series. When asked about 50 Shades of Grey by MTV in 2012, here's what she had to say.
No, I mean, that's really not my genre. Not my thing. I don't know. I've heard about it. I haven't really got into it that much. I mean, good on her. She's doing well. That's great. So,
not sounding ecstatic, but also not outraged. Do other authors share her view on fan fiction? You know, good on them?
Some do. Some think that it's a great way for a writer to get started, but that they should eventually move on to something more original. Some even do it themselves as a kind of a hobby on the sideline, just as a sort of almost like exercises that a pianist would do. And some really, really dislike people writing fan fiction about their own creations and ask their fans not to do it.
Which authors don't like being ficked, as the term goes?
Probably one of the most famous is George R. R. Martin, the author of the Game of Thrones series. And another is Diana Gabaldon, who wrote the Outlander series.
Mm-hmm. Why? What's the argument against it?
Well, I think they feel that these characters and settings belong to them, and they, you know, if they may have seen fan fiction that they didn't like or that represented their characters in ways that bothered them or offended them or just kind of grossed them out, mm-hmm. or they just feel that someone is appropriating something that is very personal to them and that they would prefer to control.
In your article, you write about Annie Proulx. Now, she was recently interviewed in the Paris Review and very upset about the short story that she wrote, Brokeback Mountain, kind of getting appropriated by fan fiction.
It's really unusual for someone who writes what we call literary fiction. This story originally appeared in The New Yorker to be ficked in this particular way. It's usually more popular series novels, genre fiction that people want to sort of take up and rework. But when Brokeback Mountain was made into a movie, a lot of people who were really moved by the characters of the situation did not like the fact that it had such a sad ending, so they changed the ending, which, as far as Proulx is concerned, she wasn't inventing a world, she was inventing a tragedy, and it was a fundamental violation of what she saw as the meaning of her work, and that, you know, she was irked by it. I mean, I think it's more common for literary writers to be off-put by this sort of thing, because we have more of a sense from literary writers that they are sort of these solitary genius types.
Mm-hmm. Is that part of the motivation, though, Laura Miller, for the reader who, you know, flings the book across the room because they're not happy with the way that the story ended? They take it upon themselves to write fan fiction?
I think that one of the main motivations for people who write fan fiction is that they want the characters or the story to go in directions that the original creator hasn't chosen. So they it's very, very common for fan fiction to focus on romantic pairings that wouldn't be part of the original work, mm-hmm. or to take the same characters and put them in a different sort of setting and see, you know, maybe a more familiar setting. There's a whole subgenre of fan fiction that takes the kind of an ensemble of characters, a group of characters from a popular story, like, say, the Harry Potter series, and makes them people who all work together in a coffee bar.
J.K. Rowling is the Harry Potter author and kind of embraces fan fiction. And I'm wondering, for the George R. R. Martin's, Anne Rice, another who is against fan fiction, or Annie Proulx, is that a limiting strategy? I mean, if we are living in the age of audience engagement, isn't fan fiction about as immersive as you can get?
Well, I don't think a writer like George R. R. Martin needs to worry about, losing fans. Mm-hmm. I mean, it tends to be really popular work that attracts this kind of attention. I think it really just depends on the author. I don't want to say that authors are wrong, because I can completely understand how, if authors create characters, there are certain things that feel right to them about those characters. Those characters might seem like real people to the authors. And in the same way that, you know, you might be freaked out if somebody wrote fan fiction about your own family, you know, you might think, you know, we would never do that, and be irked by that. And I guess I have some sympathy with that. I think with Proulx, she in particular had something she wanted to say, some social commentary she wanted to make about the impossibility of the gay relationship between the two cowboys. And so to sort of fix it by giving them a happy ending, to her, was really going against the fundamental thing she wanted to say.
Other arguments are that other people are profiting from their creations. I mean, surely E.L. James is an anomaly. Doesn't most fan fiction remain pretty obscure?
Yes. I mean, one of the beautiful things about fan fiction is that it really is what we call a gift economy. People write these stories without getting paid for them, and other people read and critique them and pass them on without getting paid for that. And that's kind of, you know, to somebody who comes mostly from the really competitive world of professional writing and publishing, there is something lovely about that. Mm-hmm. When people do make the transition from writing fan fiction to writing professionally, they tend to change identifying characteristics about the fan fiction, which is called filing off the serial numbers in the subculture. And that's what E.L. James did. I mean, I know many people who are completely bewildered by the idea that 50 Shades of Grey was Twilight fan fiction, because the characters aren't vampires. There's no, you know, supernatural element at all. But often what people are picking are sort of genre narratives that have somewhat predictable storylines. And so, I mean, Twilight is a romance, a love story. And you could say, oh, I'm going, well, obviously what E.L. James did was she thought, well, what if the vampire character was just a billionaire? And what if Bella wasn't a high school student, but she was a college freshman or whatever? And at that point, you're getting so far away from the original that you really aren't necessarily profiting off of it.
As fan fiction, however, becomes more mainstream, people are getting book deals. Is that going to become more of a concern for authors, do you think?
I guess it really depends. If the characters are very, very thinly disguised versions of the original and are attempting to capitalize on the brand of the original, which is what happens with certain kind of pirated books in China, especially, you know, kind of fake Harry Potter knockoff mm-hmm. books. Yeah, I think that authors will be bothered. But really, in order to publish, I mean, no professional publisher is going to publish something where the characters have all the same names as the characters in someone else's work, and the same settings and some of the same basic storylines. It's just inviting a copyright suit, especially if you're talking about sort of somewhat formulaic stories like romance fiction. you know, it doesn't really matter. You don't have to change that much for it to seem like, you know, more or less a new story.
We tend to think of fan fiction as an outgrowth or a product of the distribution system of the internet, right? That people can pass things around. But you trace it back much further. This has been going on for a long, long time.
Well, yes. I mean, if you want to look at just the idea of telling stories using characters that someone else invented, it goes all the way back to Homer and the Roman authors and Shakespeare. I mean, most of the characters that Shakespeare wrote about, he didn't invent himself. He retold a lot of stories, and people have been retelling stories for years. But fan fiction in its modern form really goes back to Star Trek and these mimeographed and stapled amateur fanzines that fans of that television series circulated amongst themselves in the late 60s, well, really more the 70s. And these were particularly women fans, and they were interested in particular storylines that were never going to happen in the television series. And that was when fan fiction, as we currently know it, really blossomed.
We do tend to think of the fan fiction writer as an amateur, you know, just taking a stab at these characters. Is there any great fan fiction out there, to your mind, Laura?
Well, I'm sure there probably is. I had a really hard time finding it. I found fan fiction that was okay, and every once in a while something that, you know, I thought, oh, that's pretty good. But I think, in a way, it's really more the writing and the reading and the sharing than the end product. It's sort of every single piece of fan fiction is like a work in progress in a way. And it's such a sort of a group experience that it's difficult to really apply like a term like great to it. That's like saying, well, is there any really great fairy tale? I mean, there isn't a definitive version of any fairy tale. There's just a million different tellings, and some tellings are better than others.
Laura Miller, thank you so much for bringing us into this curious world of fan fiction.
Thanks for having me.
It may be a bit dreary across New England today, but Irish eyes are smiling as ever this St. Patrick's Day. Word of Mouth returns with a look at how the holiday is celebrated in Dublin, and we'll offer our essential St. Patrick's Day playlist. That's after a quick break when Word of Mouth returns.
Francisco Vasquez Garcia, and welcome to Almeria, and we have singers.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Here in the U.S., St. Patrick's Day is all about parades and shamrocks and green beer and kiss me, I'm Irish buttons. But how do the real Irish celebrate the holiday? Maeve Conran brings us this story from Dublin.
Hail, glorious St. Patrick, dear saint of our Isle.
St. Patrick's Day, March 17th. One of the few holidays specific to a country, but now celebrated internationally. Although the image of green beer and even rivers dyed green is particular to the American experience of the day, parades and celebrations are held as far away as Russia and Korea. Even in Ireland, it's become a global affair.
We're still counting, but certainly there's, over the whole festival, I would say probably in the region of 15 different countries are represented.
Donal Shields, the CEO of the Irish St. Patrick's Festival.
We actually start off the festival on Wednesday the 16th of March, and it runs until Sunday the 20th of March. And it goes to diverse events like the Luminarium, but also on the same day we have the International
Spanning Symposium 5 days, the St. Patrick's Day celebrations in Ireland are a huge event, a whole lot different from when I was growing up. 20 years ago, it was all about wearing your best green dress to Mass, with a huge bunch of shamrocks pinned to your lapel. The highlight of the day, of course, was the parade. Not a sophisticated affair like today. Just a few floats, some marching bands, and of course, the Irish dancers. But it was magical. It was our chance to show some national pride in our national holiday, St. Patrick's Day, Lá le Féile Pórig. It's still a celebration of our national identity, what it means to be Irish. But ironically enough, Patrick himself wasn't even born there. Father Vincent O'Hara explains.
Of course, he's one of the great figures of Irish history. He wasn't born in Ireland at all. In fact, we're not sure where he was born, possibly around Wales or England. And the first time he came as a slave.
After his humble beginnings as a shepherd in slavery, Patrick escaped and fled the country that had held him captive for 2 years, but somehow ended up as its patron saint.
He said himself that he heard voices calling him from the western shores of Ireland, "Come, youth, and walk once more amongst us." So he was eventually sent then in the year 432 by Pope Celestine to Christianize Ireland, which was largely what we would call pagan up to then. The kind of religion would be a kind of a druidism. And in fact, he challenged the king at the time on the king was lighting his fire, his paschal fire, so to speak, on the hill of Tara. And Patrick lit his own paschal Easter fire on the opposite mountain or hill. And the chiefs of the king said, "Unless you put out that fire of this man Patrick, that light will never be extinguished." So it was a kind of a prophetic statement. And thank God the faith which Patrick brought to Ireland is still with us. Maybe not as strong, but it hasn't gone out. And there is the hymn which we sometimes sing, "Faith of our fathers living still in spite of dungeon, fire and sword."
So, in fact, St. Patrick's Day is a religious holiday. But for those not quite so spiritually minded, what's on offer?
Paddy's Day is just a right bit of crack all day.
Not illicit drugs, of course. Crack is the Irish word for fun. Vivian Walsh is the head barman in one of Dublin's oldest pubs.
It's a big booze up, it's a big session, St. Patrick's Day. Everybody tends to take a couple of days off either side of it and they come out in the early afternoon and don't go home until well into the next morning.
The 200-year-old Kyo's pub in the city centre sells more than 4,000 pints of Guinness on an average St. Patrick's Day alone.
On a particular St. Patrick's Day, you could be looking at getting rid of 40 kegs of Guinness, maybe. Potentially is one of our biggest days of the whole year. That taking out Christmas week, St. Patrick's Day is our busiest day.
Drinking Guinness in a traditional pub is as much a part of the national celebration as going to Mass and watching the parade. But being Irish nowadays is a different concept from that of 20 years ago. Unlike years gone by, when thousands emigrated every year, today, thousands of immigrants come to Ireland looking for work. With the new cultures and traditions that these people bring, a booming economy and a more secularised society, Father Vincent explains, there's still room to celebrate our Catholic origins.
Well, it would still be a nominally Catholic country, and I suppose as countries go, attendance at Mass would still be very high, maybe 60% that would still go at the weekends. But I think the ethos is changing, all right, the kind of Christian ethos of the country and what we call the Celtic Tiger and the newfound wealth that we have in recent decades. I suppose that has made inroads into the spirituality and the faith of the people as well.
So with more than a million people, including 250,000 tourists, set to descend on Dublin for this weekend's celebrations, there's just that one other traditional Irish element to think about. After all, it's what makes the country so green. So will it rain on the parade? Donal Shields, festival organiser.
Oh yeah, I'm under pressure big time because we've had really good weather for the last 3 years. So I'm just hoping we get it all out of the way and global warming takes its full effect.
On Erin's green valleys, look down in thy love. On Erin's green valleys.
From Dublin, this is Maeve Conran.
And of course, St. Patrick's Day would not be complete without Irish music. We asked for your suggestions to help us create an essential St. Patrick's Day playlist, and you delivered. Reels, drinking songs, and the old heart-tugging, sappy numbers. Here are just a few of your suggestions.
Thank you. Whack fold a dirty oak, there's whiskey in the jar.
Oh, Johnny boy, the pipes are calling. From glen to glen and down the mountainside.
The summer's gone and all the flowers are falling. Tis you.
And we'll all go together to pluck wild mountain thyme. All around the blooming heather will ye go, lassie, go.
And it's now.
The more the merrier with our St. Patrick's Day playlist. If you'd like to add to it, you can send us your suggestions by email, wordofmouth@nhpr.org, or add to the growing list on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. Forget the company 5K and three-day relay walks. These days, people are opting for adventure races. Think Tough Mudders and color runs. When Word of Mouth returns, we're going to find out what the adventure trend means for the classic charity race fundraising model. But first, the news.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 2013, the American Cancer Society's Relay for Life events took in a combined $380 million, making it the biggest charity race series by a long shot. And yet, despite an improving economy, many of the biggest charity races are now reporting a drop in participation and a bigger drop in money raised. Brian Alexander is an author and contributor to Outside Magazine, where he recently wrote about how the growing popularity of adventure races are to blame. And Brian, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks very much for having me on.
So how badly are charity races doing as a whole?
Well, I think it's important to remember they're still doing pretty well. What they're seeing are declines, year-over-year declines. They still take in a ton of money, but there is a growing trend toward the what I term the traditional races or traditional events, the Susan G. Komen Walk for the Cure, Cancer Society's Relay for Life, and so on, as seeing reduced numbers of income, while these sort of adventure races, mud runs, that sort of thing, are showing increases.
Do you think this is the beginning of a big decline for charity races, or maybe just a little bump in the road as these new races are introduced?
I think it's going to be a real decline, a sustained decline. It's a generational issue, and all the experts that I spoke to for my story in Outside Magazine said the same thing. Younger people, A, they like the sort of the adventure stuff, right? And secondly, they love to be treated like they're special. And you can get into a whole, like, millennial generation issue there. But when they are catered to a little bit, when they're sort of treated themselves as VIPs, and when they're doing an event that is really meant to be fun, then they're more inclined to participate in one of these charity events. For them, raising money for the charity is really secondary.
Hmm.
They want to go out and have a good time.
Yeah, and they're in these color runs, zombie runs. Those would be some of the examples of more fun-related events.
Exactly.
Now, do you think it's just an opportunity for some less established charities to get in on the popularity of adventure runs? Is that what we're seeing right now?
I think so. There is a sort of charity event industry that a lot of people don't realize exists. These are sort of the empresarios, and they are consultants, they are organizations. So let's say I have the Brian Alexander Foundation, and I want to start having a charity event. So what I would do is contract out to one of these event organizers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they're telling these people. You can raise money, come up with some great off-the-wall concept and attract a lot of 23-year-olds, and you can enter this this very lucrative area, and it is. It is its own economy, its own sort of industrial business, is raising money for charities.
Any example of those kind of fresh takes on fundraising?
The Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. They've had their income go down year over year, but they are trying now themselves to shift and be somewhat more entrepreneurial, like some of these newer charities that are entering. And they what they have seen is, for example, there's a charity race called Muckfest, which is you essentially race through mud. They're starting to do that sort of thing. Smile Train is another charity event. They do charity for cleft palate surgeries all over the world. They hooked up with the Ironman in Arizona. They did not have much of a presence in the charity race scene, and now they're sort of co-branded for that Ironman event in Arizona, and they're raising tons of money there.
Isn't Ironman a for-profit venture?
It is.
So how much money are they actually making off of something like this?
They grossed in 2013, Smile Train grossed $425,000. 2014, they almost doubled that. They grossed $800,000.
Mm.
Now, that's their gross. They've got to pay off the event organizer. They've got bills to pay as part of that. And that's something I would actually encourage people who are more concerned about the charity aspects. I would ask them to investigate a little bit about where the money all goes.
Any sources for that?
Yeah, you can go to GuideStar, for example, which is an online site. There are a couple like that. GuideStar is just one. And you can actually look at tax returns, which is what I did in preparation for this story. And they'll tell you. They have to tell you on their tax returns where the money goes, who gets paid, who doesn't get paid, how much of their money goes to lobbying, for example. A lot of people don't realize that Susan G. Komen spends a ton of money in Washington, D.C., lobbying legislators to try to get more money for breast cancer research.
Mm. I have a colleague who did a Tough Mudder, and before he signed up, he thought it was a charity event for the Wounded Warrior Project. While they do have some relationship and have helped raise a lot of money for Wounded Warrior, Tough Mudder is definitely not a charity organization. Do you think that link, that line between the for-profit event and charity race is getting a little blurry?
In the Smile Train example with the Arizona Ironman, it's essentially a co-branded event. Ironman is a commercial enterprise. Smile Train is a charity enterprise, but they co-brand together. So money is, in fact, going to Smile Train. Now, I am not completely familiar with, I'm familiar with Tough Mudders, but not what exactly the relationship is with Wounded Warrior Project. So I can't speak to that necessarily. But if they say that they're raising money, then they've got to be raising money. Or if the thing like, oh, you're going to race in a Tough Mudder, kick in $5 for the Wounded Warrior Project just off the side, will let them raise some funds at our event. I think you're talking about a different subject there. But I do agree that there is a deliberate blurring of the lines on the part of these races. I mean, people have to remember, all these races are commercial enterprises trying to make a profit. And if they can establish in the mind of a consumer that there is a charity somehow involved, hovering around the outskirts, whatever the relationship might be, that's all to the good to them, because it makes you feel good about wasting your money and your time running through mud. So there is a, I don't want to say unseemliness about it all, but there is a deliberate attempt, I think, of a lot of these races, which are really sort of just a screw away to have a good time on a Saturday, to hook themselves up with some sort of cause. And I think it's up to the consumer to investigate that.
Well, we started by talking about Relay for Life, very well-established, well-branded event. Would it be risky, do you think, for the American Cancer Society to change their model and do one of these more updated kind of fundraisers at this point?
I think it probably would because, look, they're an old-line, well-established organization. And so they've got to massage their transition from one generation to the next. A lot of their bigger money donors are going to be older because they've simply got more money. They can't just sort of wave those people goodbye and turn their attention to 22-year-olds. So I think they're going to have to do a transition strategy. I think all these old line charities are going to have to do the same thing. They're going to have to transition from the demographic of 40-year-olds, 50-year-olds, down to 20-year-olds, and they're going to have to do it very gradually so that they don't alienate either party.
Brian Alexander, author and contributor to Outside Magazine, thank you for speaking with us.
You're quite welcome.
You'll find a link to read Brian's article on how charity races are losing revenue to adventure runs and the like. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. We'll also have a link to GuideStar there for you. It is an admirable thing to go out and run a 5K or half marathon for a good cause. But for one family, charitable giving begins at home. Philip Grazer has the story of the Salwins, who decided that the best way to make a difference in the world was to downsize from a 7-bedroom home to something a little more sustainable.
In 2006, 14-year-old Hannah Salwin and her dad were stopped at a traffic light in downtown Atlanta. She looked out the car window.
I looked to my left and I saw this homeless man sitting on the sidewalk holding up a sign that said, homeless, please help. And then on my right, I saw a man in a Mercedes coupe. And I toggled back and forth between the haves and the have-nots. And I said to my dad, you know, if that guy to my right, the man in a Mercedes, didn't have such a nice car, then the man, the homeless man, could have a meal.
That night at dinner, Hannah was still angry at the world's inequities. Her dad, a writer and entrepreneur, tried to explain that their family was really trying to make a difference. But Hannah would have none of it.
I said, you know, I don't want to be a family that just talks about doing something. I want to really get out there and I want to make a difference. And my mom, kind of in a fit of frustration, said, oh, what do you want to do? You want to sell the house? And I said, yeah, that is what I want to do.
So they decided to sell their house, move into one half its size, and donate half the sales price to charity. Their old house, according to Hannah's dad, Kevin, was one of the grandest in Ansley Park.
It was set back from the street, had these two-story Corinthian columns, wraparound porches, a beautiful original tile roof.
To Hannah, it was a perfect tool for her charitable work. But Kevin wasn't convinced until he started to think about all his belongings.
I recognized we had more house than we need. We had more stuff than we need. I also realized that, hey, this could be kind of fun. It was kind of a little bit of a journey into the unknown.
Since everyone had to give up something, furniture, toys, electronics, books, Hannah's mom, Joan, thought each ought to have an equal say in giving away the proceeds from the house sale. It would be one person, one vote. Hannah was delighted.
It felt really good to know that if we had something to say, that my parents would be listening and that they would actually take it into consideration and not just say, okay, they don't know what they're talking about because whatever.
It took about a year to decide what group the Salwins were going to support. On Sunday mornings, they'd meet over bagels to discuss the projects. Finally, they chose the Hunger Project. Its philosophy matched their family's thinking.
What we loved about the Hunger Project was that their methodology was, we trust in the people in these communities to build their own futures.
The $800,000 from the house sale is helping two villages in Ghana. Hannah doesn't miss the old house. It was more than she needed. She and her dad have written a book, The Power of Half, that they hope will inspire others.
Obviously, not many people are going to sell their house, but there are so many things and so many opportunities that you can be a part of. If your family watches 4 hours of TV a week, you could cut that down to two and use those 2 hours to help in a homeless shelter.
The Salwins are adjusting to their smaller house in Ansley Park. There's no longer a separate room for the ping pong table, and the dinner table doubles as a computer workstation. But still, Kevin thinks they got a great deal.
I think we're a family that honestly set out to do a little bit of good, and we are doing a little bit of good. But the good we did for ourselves, I think in some ways dwarfs the good we did for mankind.
And that is the power of half. I'm Philip Grazer.
If you're on Facebook, you've likely seen a friend or family member post a dubious story and thought to yourself, that cannot be true. Up next, we're going to hear from a social media strategist who took it upon herself to fact-check every questionable link posted by a family member. Her story when Word of Mouth continues. Yeah. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. We've all seen them, those emails or Facebook posts that begin, "You won't believe this," followed by something like, "FBI evidence shows Boston Marathon bombing was an inside job. Using Facebook Messenger requires acceptance of privacy-violating conditions." The writer, blogger, and social media strategist Liz Lenz saw this one on her grandma's Facebook feed. "President Obama is trying to remove 'In God We Trust' from U.S. currency." Liz decided she'd fact-check every link, meme, and news story posted by a family member, none of whom believed that what they posted was wrong. So why, with unprecedented access to the facts, do internet myths and scams and hoaxes persist, even after they've been snooped? Her article, Fact Checking Grandma, appeared on Aeon. And Liz Lenz, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Were you ever able to convince your grandma that the "In God We Trust" threat was not a real one?
No, I wasn't able to. In fact, right after this experiment, I saw my grandma for Christmas, and she took me aside and told me that, you know, no matter what I thought, that the president was godless and would do something terrible to this country, you know, like taking God We Trust off the currency or something worse. So it wasn't so much that she was committed to that story. It's just that she's committed to this idea that he's a terrible president.
Well, in your fact-checking of that, you did discover a germ of truth, however. What?
Well, what I discovered is that there had been some coins previously, not under the Obama administration, but previously printed without that slogan on them, but it was a mistake. And there's actually a second germ of truth in that there is somebody who is currently trying to sue the government to get this slogan off of the currency. And he's Michael Newdow. If you look him up, I think he still has a pending lawsuit about something out there. So he's actively trying to do this.
Social media plays a huge role in allowing these kind of untruths in news feeds. What does Facebook have to say about the idea that they are perpetuating myths?
Recently, in a Slate article, somebody who works for Facebook was talking about how this idea of what we think is fact and what we think isn't fact is really fluid. Interestingly enough, Google just announced that they're going to try to change their search engine rankings based on fact. But the Facebook representative was saying that, you know, as a social media company, you can't really get into the business of policing the truth, because truth, no matter what we like to think about it, it can be very, very fluid depending on how you see the world.
Mm-hmm. And I noticed that a number of commenters to your article, you know, say that Snopes is not a trustworthy source for the truth. I'm interested in your digging into a number of persistent pre-internet era myths, one especially odd, the pig-faced lady of Dublin. What was the story there?
Yes, this is so interesting. Pig-faced lady stories have existed for a long time, but my favorite, maybe I shouldn't say favorite because it's really sad, but is the story of Grizel Stevens, who lived in Dublin, and she was a very wealthy lady, came into a lot of money when her father and her twin brother passed away. And she was a philanthropist, and she'd drive around town and she'd have her servants, you know, pass out money. And she funded a huge hospital project, but she also had very weak eyes. So she would travel around with a veil over her face. And I'm sure the image of this wealthy lady driving around Dublin in a fancy carriage, you know, passing out money, was very intriguing to the people in her city. And they started telling a story that she was actually a pig-faced lady. I think somehow it became viral in Dublin at the time, and people would jump on her carriage and make pig noises. For a while, if you went to visit the hospital, they would show a silver trough where she had apparently eaten, where their benefactors had eaten. And I don't think the trough is there at the hospital. I think recently, actually, people said, all right, enough is enough. And I think the trough is in a nearby pub. But
the thing that's crazy about this, this is an 18th century Dublin. Yeah. She died in, what, 1747?
Yeah.
She knew of these rumors, and she would deliberately, you know, stand out on her veranda and to remove her veil to show people that she didn't have a pig face.
Right. And I just think of that image of her just standing there on her veranda, like looking at everybody, you know, thinking, look at me, I don't have a pig face. And yet, I mean, the truth is so accessible. And yet people just persisted in believing that she had a pig face. It took such a hold of the city that the story still exists today.
And of course, there are stories about, you know, Catherine the Great having dying while having sex with a horse. There's the ancient idea that Jews use the blood of Christian babies to make matzah balls. Even if they're complete fabrications, we're suckers. So why do we like them? What is the payoff to believing in these absolute untruths?
One of the books, I was reading this book about the culture of death in the Civil War, and the author talked about how in the newspapers at the time, writers would just outright lie about the last words of Thomas Jefferson and John Adams and George Washington. And it occurs to me that people probably knew at the time there were more newspapers per person back in those days than there are now, even though literacy was down. But so you had to think that people knew, but they still clung to these stories because they help us make meaning out of the world. I think sometimes when you look at the world, it just looks like this disparate mishmash of ideas and stories and thoughts, and you don't know how to put it all together. Shaping these stories into gives us meaning. I heard Vivian Gornick speak last night, the essayist, and she said, life is what happens. Stories are what you make. It's just how we kind of make meaning of this crazy world we live in.
Well, you also looked at some research from the Wharton School at UPenn assessing what makes stories go viral. Did their findings support that idea that we cling to things that somehow confirm our beliefs?
Their findings more confirmed that the stories that we share have that emotional connection to us. They make us angry. They make us happy.
But one could be cynical and think that Facebook would actually benefit from these viral-ready stories being passed around. It's a lot more traffic for them, right?
Yeah, well, yes, that's definitely an excellent point. And there's also people out there benefiting from these viral stories, not just Facebook, but there are spam companies that set up Facebook pages and kind of create these viral stories and then have everybody share them, and so that they get likes, and then they'll sell this Facebook fan page that has 30,000 likes to a company or something like that. So, you know, it does go a little bit beyond just making you happy. You're right to be cynical. People are profiting from your vulnerability.
Well, I guess I'm cynical because I've read too many stories about how evil Facebook is on the internet. Liz Lenz, her article, Fact Checking Grandmother, appeared on Eon. Liz, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
You can read Liz's article for yourself. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. And let me tell you, the comment sections may be worth it in and of themselves. We're so grateful for your listening time today. If you missed any of the show, you can hear it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. Better yet, subscribe to the podcast so you never miss Word of Mouth. You can go to wordofmouthradio.org or search Word of Mouth NHPR on iTunes. And don't forget, we're compiling an essential St. Patrick's Day playlist and would love to hear your contribution of song, no matter how smarmy it is. You can send us an email, wordofmouth@nhpr.org, or go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. And we'll be back tomorrow at 2 with our shorter, much improved, springier March fundraiser. Please do what you can to help support the programming that you love and make NHPR's fundraiser 7 days shorter. Hope you can join us here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray,
with help from our intern,
Katie McAuliffe.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.